This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Aaron Camaro and Chris Sinzak.
Y'all down with this? We're going to try to liven it up. We know how it is. You're listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast, probably at work, maybe on your way to work. Everybody's looking tired. No surprises. We're tired of that. We need something different, something new. We need to shock the people. I'm Aaron Camaro. That's Chris Sinzak. Are you ready to shock the people?
You look like Tupac today. What happened?
What up, homie?
What's going on?
I got all my homies with me. Welcome to the Decibel Geek Podcast and the world that is 1996.
And a Kiss reference right off the top.
Right off the top, man.
Well, yeah, for those of you that are Kiss fans, we don't have to explain why this is an important year.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have a lot of fun with this one. It's been a long time since we've done a year in review. We decided to pick a weird year because we're always picking cool years like the 70s and the 80s. Yeah. But the 90s often gets overlooked. Mm-hmm. And 1996 is kind of a tough year. But there are some gems, and we're going to cover it all here today.
Yeah, you're going to hear a wide variety of stuff today. And from basically, you know, we do rock and metal. You're gonna hear all facets of rock and metal today,
for sure. But before we get to that, we got to take care of some business. And my favorite way to start the Decibel Geek Podcast is with a sweet 5-star review. Doesn't matter if it comes from iTunes or Facebook. We appreciate them all the same. This one in particular comes to us from Facebook, and it's from Mike Parnell. And it goes a little something like this. Just subscribed a couple of weeks ago. Really good show. I'm hearing songs I've never heard before, and I consider myself a hard rock guru. Thanks, guys. Amazing stuff. Awesome. Right? Sweet. To the point. Like it. New listener.
Brand
right
new
on
listener.
Board.
Yeah.
This guy's going to get to enjoy all kinds of great stuff in the archives over the last many, many years.
Yeah, just go to decibelgeek.com and click on the episodes tab, and there's over 300 hours of things for you to listen to right there.
It's all there, including last week's episode with Perry Richardson. Yeah. 6 songs. Man, that was great.
It was good. It turned out good, and we had a great response from it. Perry had a good time on the show. Striper even, you know, retweeted and shared it on their Facebook.
Right on.
And I was talking to a friend. And I said, thank God, pun intended.
Yeah, right. Sure.
But it was cool, and I'd say that's definitely our most popular 6 songs that we've done.
Right on.
Well, next to the Ian Wadley one, of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
But it was great having Perry on, and Striper started to release dates now for next year. Nothing in Nashville yet, but we have hope that it's
coming. We got our fingers crossed. I'm sure wherever you live, you got your fingers crossed for it too.
Yeah.
So when they do come around, make sure to get out there, support them, say hi to Perry.
Yeah, please do. For Geeks of the Week, these are the people that shared on Facebook and retweeted on Twitter last week's 6 songs Perry Richardson thinks you should hear. Geeks of the Week this week are Joe Royland, Adam Cox, Matt Ashcraft, Tony Musalam from Restrained, Todd Cunningham, Kevin Williams, Joshua Toomey from Talk to Me Podcast, Jeff Rich, Perry Richardson himself shared it. Alan Tate from the Ages of Rock Podcast. I want to congratulate Alan and his co-hosts on 100 episodes.
Just
passed that.
That's awesome.
Bacco from Cobras and Fire, James Bennett, Brennan Barrier, Jeffrey Mendenhall, Mikhail Burrell, Wayne Cross, Joseph Capone, Mark Alden Taylor, Sean Cullen, Greg McGlone, Christina Green, Forgotten Rock Community, Mackenzie Goleg. I can't even pronounce this one.
You should be able to pronounce that one.
It's
like your cousin.
Garen Smith Music, Aaron Baker, Rob Webb, Jerry Ritz, Covers and Fire Podcast, Freeform Rock Podcast, Dan Chef, Who Sit and Spin with Joe, Growing Up Rock Podcast, Kissy Groove, Sonny Hollywood Pooney, Jay Shabluski. See, I can get Shabluski.
Plenty of practice.
So if Mackenzie, keep sharing the show, and I'll get better with your name as time goes on. Andrew Jacobs, Bradley Bauer, Master Save Rock and Metal. That's a really cool Twitter profile that came up, and they share a lot of rock podcasts. So I want to give them a shout out. Stephen Michael, Ernesto Aguiar, JJ Matt, Christopher Stokes, Derek Novak, and of course,
The Mooger Fooger. You know, we mentioned one name in there, Bacco, man. He's been killing it at DecibelGeek.com, man, putting out some amazing articles, some really cool cutting-edge stuff.
Yeah, we're putting more news items out now.
That's cool. I see it all over the place.
It's getting a lot of attention, especially, the new maybe when we're done tonight, we'll do a VIP segment about the new Gene Simmons story that just came out.
We just got done talking about Gene Simmons, and bam, here's some more.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So join the VIP thing on Patreon, and
keep your eyes on DecibelGeek.com.
Yeah.
And check out Cobras and Fire.
Yeah, great show. I listen to those guys every week. So we're all ready to get into
1996. Now, I think this should come with a little disclaimer. I mean, do you got your facts for the year?
Yeah. A few, okay. I've got not a lot, but a few.
Okay, but the pertinent ones that we like to start our year in review with. I mean, that's where we got to start.
Yeah, you want to start with that?
Yeah.
Well, first off, how old were you in 1996?
Let's see, 1996, 1920-ish, around in there.
I was 19, and I turned 20 in November of that year. I think you're about a year older than me, right?
I guess I turned in May, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay. So that gives you an idea where we were personally.
Right.
1996 facts, average monthly rent was $554. That would
nice.
Be nice.
I remember that.
That's the cost of a month's rent of a closet in downtown Nashville now.
Right.
Cost of a gallon of gas was $1.22. U.S. postage stamp was 32 cents. We don't even use those anymore.
Not really.
And the price of a pound of bacon was $2.90.
That's the most important thing we always got to know at the beginning of our year in reviews.
I actually dig a little harder to find the price of bacon for 1996.
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't readily available.
That's weird.
Even to calculate some stuff. Yeah.
All right, well, before we get into the world of 1996, I think this should come with a little bit of disclaimer because, you know, in the 70s we had, you know, the kids in Satan's Service, and in the 80s we had the evil powers of metal and Ozzy Osbourne and Judas Priest controlling our weak minds and getting us to do things we wouldn't do. The 90s are no different. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you about the evils of alternative rock.
Okay.
For example, in early 96, two Washington State teenagers are charged in a triple murder when they team up to kill one of their own families. When asked why they did it, they blamed the murderous influence of the most demonic band of the mid-90s, Silverchair.
For real?
For real. Oh, specifically, the lyrics of the song Israel's Son. The court would exonerate Silverchair, and the band would condemn the actions of the young murderers, but welcome to 1996 and the evil powers of alternative rock.
Could we prosecute them for shit taste in music? I didn't ever like Silverchair.
They're all right. They ain't so bad.
Can I share a couple of odd stories I found on a website?
Sure.
This is bizarre. First one, Mary Tyler Moore. You're familiar with her. She offered a restaurant $1,000 to sell her a 65-year-old lobster so she could return it to the wild.
It was 65 years old, must have still been alive then, right?
Yeah.
Huge, I would imagine.
Rush Limbaugh then offered $2,000 to eat the lobster.
What?
The restaurant denied both officers and kept it as a mascot.
Wow. Crazy.
And the next story.
People with nothing better to do in 96.
Yeah. During a blizzard in Allentown, Pennsylvania, the Orlando Magic, Marilyn Manson, and the cast of Sesame Street Live were all stranded in a hotel together.
Oh, wow. We got to get Marilyn Manson on the show and ask him about that.
Man, I'm imagining a Marilyn Manson with Sesame Street mashup. That would be awesome.
I just think Marilyn Manson probably hiding out in the deepest, darkest bowels of the building.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, and then one more. I think I mentioned it to you. I didn't put it on the notes, but in New Zealand, a guy broke into a radio station and held the DJ hostage, forcing him to play Rainbow Connection by Kermit the Frog on repeat.
Wow. Not nothing metal. Not nothing cool. Kermit the Frog.
Rainbow Connection.
Insane.
Yep. So 1996 was a strange time.
Sure was. Let's get into the rock and roll. If we're going to talk about anything, you know, this is Decibel Geek. You know, we're doing a year in review. Mm. So we're going to take it through the eyes of hard rock and classic metal. And this is a great place to start. I'm talking about Accept, their 11th studio album, Predator. It's produced by Michael Wagner at Sound Studios right here in Nashville, Tennessee. And, you know, it's 1996, so it's been 12 years since Balls to the Wall, and Accept has gone through a lot since then. In 1987, Udo Dirkschneider left the band to start a solo career, and Accept would release one album, Eat the Heat, with a different singer, and Udo would release four studio albums before getting the band back together in 93.
Mm-hmm.
They're on a roll through the mid-90s, creating some really, really great music, and 1996's Predator is no exception. Great songs like Crucified, Ain't Over Yet, Predator, and Digging in the Dirt. whole album's really good. I like it a lot.
I was depressed that it wasn't a cover of the Peter Gabriel song.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Sure. You know, the production is obviously top-notch. Every instrument and voice is so crisp and clear and powerful. Peter Baltus even sings lead vocals on three of the tracks, and mm-hmm. I don't think that guy gets his due for his singing ability.
I like his singing.
Because the songs on here are pretty kick-ass. They didn't know it at the time, but this would be the last Accept album for almost 15 years and the last to feature Udo on vocals ever.
Yep.
It did not chart in the UK or in the US, but was highly acclaimed in Northern Europe and in Japan. Except 96.
That album completely went over my head at the time.
Obviously, it went over everybody's.
Yeah, I don't even remember when it coming out or anything.
Yeah, no, me neither.
Interesting.
That's one of them good ones in retrospect.
Yeah.
So here's something cool also that happened in 96. In an attempt to earn the 1996 Humanitarian Award, the authorities fire several shots at Jimmy Buffett's plane after it lands in Jamaica. It's got Jimmy Buffett and Bono from U2 on board. Actually, what it was, they thought the plane belonged to wanted drug smugglers, and it nearly cost Bono and his family their lives.
Yikes.
For real. It was crazy.
I really want to make a joke right now, but probably shouldn't.
Right. It's funny in retrospect, yeah. But at the time, I'm sure it was terrible.
So, in January, on the 25th, Mr. Big put out the Hey Man album. Well, came out in Japan in January, which is we might as well call that their home turf because they were bigger in Japan than they ever were here.
This is going to be a reoccurring theme in 96. A lot of these bands are doing really good in
other countries,
Northern Europe and in, Sweden and Norway and Germany and places like that, but especially Japan.
Yeah.
A lot of the bands that had seen the downfall when grunge kind of rose in the early 90s are still killing it in Japan.
Yeah, and this was their fourth studio album, the last one they did with Paul Gilbert until 2010, because Richie Kotzen came on board after that. It was produced by Kevin Elson, mixed by Tom Size, which I always thought was funny that a guy named Tom Size worked on the Mr. Big albums.
it was meant to be.
This album didn't yield any radio hits, but it's filled with the requisite hooks, chops, and soulful vocals you'd expect from a Mr. Big album.
Right on.
Tracks that stand out for me are Trapped in Toyland, The Chain, and Where Do I Fit In? Don't you call me by the way I face your picture. I'm happy just the way I am. Been strong into my bones, down under pressure. Yeah, I'm a bastard of a master plan. Mr. Big rolls on to this day, even though they were not around for a while there.
No, it's good. Huge stuff in Japan going on in 96. Not so much the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Also in the news in early 96, not to be outdone by Jamaica. Argentina wants to kill Madonna.
Gosh.
They are not amused by a notorious American slut's portrayal of their cultural icon, Eva Perón.
Oh, the Don't Cry For Me Argentina thing.
Indeed.
Okay. Yeah.
They were mad.
I didn't know they were upset about that.
Like, seriously mad. They didn't want her to come there. They didn't want nothing to do with her.
Huh.
So get your skank ass out of here.
Wow, man. Well, a lot of harsh words from Madonna here.
Yeah, they didn't like it.
Wow. Okay.
Hey, I'm not. Don't cry for me.
Well, you called her iconic American slut.
Well, I mean, back then, isn't that what she was kind of known as?
Madonna's not a slut. She was totally wholesome. What are you talking about?
Oh, yeah. She only had a book called Sex with naked ass pictures in it. That was probably not too long before this.
I've seen that book. I read it for the articles, though.
I bet you did.
Yeah.
In the mid-80s, the classic Mark II lineup of Deep Purple reunited to great response. But before the end of the 80s, Gillan and Blackmore were getting along about as well as ever, and Gillan is fired and replaced by JoLynn Turner. Mm. In the mid-90s, with pressure from the record company, Turner was let go and Gillan was brought back for the band's 25th anniversary. Again, Gillan and Blackmore, they just can't coexist. But this time, Blackmore's the one who walks. When Steve Morse is recruited to take the place of Blackmore, the band feels rejuvenated, and they enter the studio in Altamont, Florida, to record Perpendicular. Perpendicular does not crack the U.S. album charts at all. That's crazy. It sucks. But it does really well, like I said, in Europe and, of course, Japan. And with the exception of Don Airey, who replaced John Lord in 2002, this is the lineup that has lasted to this very day.
Yeah, and I love the sound of that album. I think it's produced well. I think it sounds like a classic Deep Purple record. I mean, but then again, you know, were people clamoring for a classic sounding Deep Purple album in 1996?
Definitely not. Not here. Not in the States.
Not really. And, here's something completely different. Bruce Dickinson puts out a solo album in 1996. I'm using quotes when I say solo album.
Yeah.
Skunk Works came out on February 19th. Originally, it was intended for it to be the debut album of a band by that name. And Skunk Works is like a military term.
Okay.
Like military intelligence, I think. However, the label, much like with Tony Iommi in the 80s, would not allow him to record under any other name than Bruce Dickinson. Like, you have the marquee value of your name, so you're going to be Bruce. And
because there was big news when he left Maiden, you know, so people wanted to know what he was up to if you just call it Skunk Works.
Yeah, and it's considered a stab as an alternative album. And that is backed up by the choice of Jack and Dino for the producer. He did Nirvana's first album.
Now there's the evil powers of alternative rock.
highlights on Skunk Works include Inertia, Dream State, and Back from the Edge. Alternative thing got labeled on this album, but I think that's selling it short. I mean, it's even if that's what they were going for, I think it's a really well done album and it's got a lot of good playing on it. And that's the song that I just spun, I think, has a real Rush vibe to it. It sounds more like Rush than it does Nirvana.
There's a lot of cool stuff going on in 96 with these classic era bands. kind of experimenting and trying new things because, I mean, who were they got to impress in 96?
Yeah. But, I mean, this album and Tattooed Millionaire, I like Bruce's solo material quite a bit. Yeah. And I think he just put out like a box set from the Skunk Works stuff.
Oh, right on. You know, 96 is a great time for rock. If you're the Goo Goo Dolls, Dishwalla, or Collective Soul.
Yeah.
But for a band like Enough's Enough, the landscape appears quite differently. Now, just 3 years prior, they had been personally signed by Clive Davis to Arista Records. But after the Animals with Human Intelligence album failed to chart in anywhere but Japan, they were quickly dropped. Derek Frigo and Vic Fox would both leave the band, but Chip and Donnie kept it going, releasing independent albums and touring almost endlessly. They're in this kind of crazy limbo where they're not popular enough to be considered a high-drawing act, but yet they're so popular that it necessitates that they continue to release new music and tour. That's something that Chip and Donnie have no problem with because they have millions of great songs. So much so that throughout the 90s, they would release full albums of bonus material in between the releases of new music, including 1996's Peach Fuzz. Originally released only in Japan, popularity for the import warranted a U.S. release via Caroline Records, which had become the label responsible for launching White Zombie, Hole, and the Smashing Pumpkins. Peach Fuzz is made up of mostly extra songs from 93's Animals album, as well as one of their most well-known songs and possibly the greatest Christmas carol of all time, Happy Holiday, which was written but never used for the soundtrack of the 1992 movie Home Alone 2.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It's a great song.
Peach Fuzz also includes two songs that were on the 1991 Mother's Eyes single B-side tracks on the UK version, Let It Go and Kitty. Except Japan, where it reached number 78 on the Oricon charts. Still to this day, Enough's Enough albums chart nowhere.
Yeah.
But Japan, where they always crack the top 200. Compilation album or not, Chip and Donnie wrote thousands of great songs.
And the Peach Fuzz album's got a lot of good stuff on it.
Really good stuff.
I don't know. If you're into like power pop rock at all, then... And you haven't really dug into Enough's Enough's catalog, then there's a treasure trove of stuff for you
to get into. I own everything by the band that I can get my hands on. I love it.
Man, definitely one of our most interesting interviews with Donnie V there.
For sure.
And Chip's coming to town in 2018. So.
Yeah, so keep your eyes open on that. We're going to be going to that for sure. So if you guys are in town, check out DecibelGeek.com. We'll get the information
out there. But yeah, I'm hoping that we can get Chip for an hour and talk to him about... You know, his side of everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chip Saint Chocolate.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's going to be the first question.
So awesome.
Oh, man. So then, you know, I said we were going to span, you know, all parts of the rock genre in here, and this is going to prove that. Bad Religion put out The Gray Race on February 27th. I think I've played a little bit of Bad Religion on the show before. You know, I don't play a lot of punk on the show because we tend to hold and stay to hard rock, but this is... Like, there wouldn't be a Green Day without a Bad Religion. And, like, there wouldn't have been a Rancid without a Bad Religion. This band has been around.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Well, yeah, maybe I'm not selling them the right way here. I'm just saying they were they were kind of criminally underrated when it comes to like power pop punk. You know, they're not just angry. They're actually, there's melody to their music. And I got into them around this time. They put out The Gray Race, which was their ninth studio album. It's the follow up to 94 Stranger Than Fiction, which is where I came on board as a fan. This album was recorded at Electric Lady Studios and produced by Rick Ocasek from The Cars.
Oh, wow.
Only one song that did much on the charts from this one was Walk, but my favorite track on this one is called Empty Causes. I know Bad Religion is still around and still doing their thing. I'd love to see them live once, but I don't know that they've ever played Nashville. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong.
So you're going to find out in 1996 that there are a lot of top record companies dropping the rock acts in favor of alternative and hip-hop artists in the early 90s. One label that emerges in the early 90s, it's a new record company called CMC International.
Yep.
They emerge as a new home for rock and metal artists. They pick up many bands that have recently been dropped by major labels but refuse to die, including Wasp, Judas Priest, Vixen, Slaughter, Motorhead, Saxon, Warrant, Kix. The list goes on and on. These guys were on the case. After getting the boot from Atlantic, Tom Lipsky and CMC were more than happy to go into business with Overkill. And that wasn't the only major transition going on in the world of Overkill, because along with the loss of major label support, they also lost their longtime twin guitar attack of Merritt Gant and Rob Canavino. In their place, they hire Sebastian Marino, who played on the Anvil album Worth the Wait, and Joe Como, who's former lead vocalist of a Priest tribute band that turns into kind of legendary thrash guys, like deep underground. You ever heard of Liege Lord?
Mm-mm.
A lot of our favorite thrash metal bands love Liege Lord.
Huh.
He's also a guitar player, but he adds a whole new vocal dynamic along with Blitz and Dee Dee for the 1996 album The Killing Kind. Now, being off a major label, I'm guessing it must have made them feel like they could experiment with their sound. And boy, did they ever. That this is Overkill's music from The Elder.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's very divisive amongst hardcore fans.
Well, that song in particular, though, that follows kind of falls in line with what you...
It does, but there's some odd stuff on there. I mean, it doesn't chart anywhere except for Germany, and it's definitely a different kind of Overkill album. I dig it myself. I think it's pretty good. There's some cool stuff on there outside the box of what you would expect from Overkill in a lot of cases. It's definitely not the album I would recommend to somebody wanting to check out Overkill for the first time.
Right.
But there is plenty of cool stuff on there.
I'll have to give it a deep listen because I only really know what you played on here because I wasn't following Overkill around that time.
Yeah, Overkill in 96, man. You know, we've played some good stuff and showcased some good stuff already in the show, but, you know, 96 was kind of tough because, I mean, we were in the thralls of the alternative rock, you know, and I never really understood alternative rock because to me it was all rock and roll music. It was just different styles. The bands had different looks, but it was all rock music. And my always favorite thing to say back in the day was alternative. Alternative to what? Kick-ass rock and roll?
Mm-hmm.
But nobody ever thought it was funny in 96. But there was something that was happening in 96 that made me forget about all the music around me that was new that I didn't like.
Yeah.
Something that came from the past that was amazing, that was going to be new again.
Didn't ABBA get back together that year?
I think there was an ABBA reunion.
Oh, okay.
But this even...
Oh, you're not talking about
this
that.
This even overshadowed that.
Bay City Rollers.
Even overshadowed that.
Wow, this is something.
I'm talking about the one and only, the reuniting of the greatest band of all freaking time, Kiss! In 1996, where were you when you found out Kiss was getting back together?
I was driving home from work. I was working at Pizza Hut at the time, and I had a cell phone in 1996.
Yeah?
I had one of the early ones that was, like, massive. It looked like a brick. And I was driving home from Pizza Hut, and the guy who was the singer in my band, who was older than me and was not a Kiss fan, calls me up and he goes, "Hey, I just want to let you know I just saw Kiss on TV," which in 1996, that was weird.
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Oh, cool." He's like, "Yeah, they were on the Grammys." I was like, "The Grammys?" He's like, "Yeah, they were, like, it's the original guys with the makeup and the costumes." I'm like, "What?" Which, I mean, we knew it was coming.
Right.
But I was like, "Oh, now they've unveiled it." And I was like, "How they look?" He's like, "They look fat and old." I was like, "Oh, you fucking asshole." But no, that's how I first heard that. And then, as far as I was in college for the press conference.
Yeah.
And I remember it had to have been no more than an hour or two after the press conference happened that I saw MTV, you know, broke in and did, like, they had done a news story on it.
Right.
And that was, and then I was glued to MTV for the rest of the day waiting for it to rerun. You know, it was the MTV news. You hear it? I think I must have watched it 4 or 5 times that day on MTV just because I was so excited.
Exciting times, man.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
I never thought
Dream
I'd
come
see
true.
It. I never thought I'd see it. And then all of a sudden it was real. You know, it was really going to happen. And the tour was coming around to places that I could actually get to, you know.
Yeah, because it was the Midwest was where they started.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a wild time, and but to go back, you know, to 95 when they did MTV Unplugged, which
right.
I'll spin something off that here, because MTV Unplugged came out in 1996, the album.
That's right.
But when I first heard about that, because they recorded that in August of 95,
right?
But it didn't get shown on MTV until Halloween night. And I was in my dorm room in college, my first semester of college.
I was so excited for that,
me too.
Man. I was over at my buddy's house, my number one Kiss fan friend growing up, Jason. We were over at his house waiting for it to come on. I was so excited. I can't think of anything in the, like, early to mid-90s entertainment-wise I was more excited for than the anticipation of Kiss Unplugged, because you knew Gene and you knew Ace and Peter were going to be there.
Yeah, and... You know, I was in love with that era of the band, too, like the 90s.
Right.
The Eric Singer, Bruce Kulick version. So,
sure.
MTV Unplugged is kind of like the best of both worlds.
Totally.
You know, because before Ace and Peter come out, you get a great performance of the four that were in the band at the time.
Yeah.
And then you get the reunion on top of it.
And then you get all of them.
Then you get all of them. I mean, it's like, it's honestly, I mean, you could consider it one of the best albums they ever did.
It's one of my favorite live albums of all time,
yeah,
for sure.
Because it's so unique. And also, it was it was kind of a it felt like a middle finger from us fans to people that were like, they can't play their instruments.
Right.
Because, like, watch that.
Yeah.
And because they sound amazing on it. And I had this was a couple of years later, but I was dating this girl who didn't like them at all. And she was a singer. And, you know, she thought she knew better than everybody and all this shit. And I was like, you need to watch Kiss Unplugged. And she's like, I'm not going to watch Kiss because they can't play their instruments. They suck. And I sat her down and I watched it. And I think we got through like 3 or 4 songs and she was just quiet the whole time. And then I looked over at her. She's like, fuck you. I was like, what? She's like, they're good. They actually sound good. She's like, I actually like this.
Now you're going to say I was going to lean over and be like, in your face, bitch.
Well, I pretty much did. But that was anytime anyone would, you know, claim that Kiss was untalented, I would, you know, play them in TV Unplugged because they sound great on that.
Yeah.
They can sing, they sing on it and everything.
And it was cool because after years and years of being told Kiss sucks and, you know, finding rare fans, fellow fans that you could become friends with, but most people just shit and piss on Kiss and make fun of you for liking them. In 1996, it was pretty damn cool to be a Kiss fan because all of a sudden, all the people that used to give you hell for liking Kiss are all huge Kiss fans now.
Yeah.
Because of the reunion.
Oh, yeah, because it was the cool thing to see. Because
it was the coolest thing in the world going on. Yeah. I mean, when you watch, and you can watch it on YouTube, the announcement tonight with Tupac bringing Kiss out and showing there's a little piece where it shows them backstage where they pretty much get right off that bus, walk right on through, say hi to a couple of people in the press, go straight on stage. Oh, they don't even say hi to them. They just pose. They don't say a freaking word. The cameras are going off. People are going nuts.
Yeah.
They walk straight out past a few people and right onto the stage. And you look at, like, the bands that are being announced for awards. The Eagles are there. Yeah. They're looking impressed as hell. Like, they're even amazed at seeing Kiss on stage. And, you know, it's cool. They pan the audience. People are just, their mouths are wide open. Their eyes are all wide. Mm-hmm. And they can't believe what they're seeing because in 1996 and since, you know, the late 70s, there hasn't been anything like Kiss, including Kiss.
Right. Yeah, it was a magical year.
Right? Yeah.
And like from the end of 95 into 96, just it was a blur because, like I said, I was in college and like even I had roommates and friends that would get in that got into it too. They got caught up in the excitement of it too. And then, of course, the MTV Video Music Awards performance, you know, under the Brooklyn Bridge. That impressed. I had like 3 people hanging out in my room that night at the dorms and you know, we're watching the awards show sucks leading up to it. It's just terrible.
Right.
And like we're watching
96.
And, like, yeah, it's like all the performances are lame or they're off key because there's no auto tune back then. At least they were playing live. And then Kiss closed the show. And I remember all of my friends in the room were like, God, well, Kiss was the best part of the whole thing. And these were people that had no clue about Kiss.
Right.
And I was worried. I was like, God, I hope they're not like, oh, those guys are idiots.
That's the great thing about it. I mean, when they came back strong.
They put the work in.
They did.
And they, you know, I'm sure it was a cash grab and they made their money, but they did not half-ass it. They truly did their best to try to recreate what people remembered from the 70s.
Yeah, and the time was right.
Yeah, it was totally right. Well, you know, some people don't know, they tried to do a reunion tour in 1990 when Hot in the Shade was out.
I think that would have been too soon.
Well, they wanted Ace to get on board and have Eric Carr do the makeup.
That would have been so great.
It would have been great, but promoters weren't willing to pay what they were asking.
Yeah.
So then they just said, no, we'll wait. And they waited 6 more years, and then they made a fucking fortune.
Yeah.
But so to go back to, you know, how it all got rolling, the MTV Unplugged performance was recorded at Sony Studios on August 9th, 1995. A little quick piece of trivia on this that I didn't know till I researched this. Phil Ashley played keys on the Every Time I Look at You segment. And if you remember, Phil Ashley's the guy that plays keys on Crazy Nights.
Oh,
he's also the guy that got Gary Corbett the job playing with Kiss.
That's right.
Because they were friends.
Right on.
So could have picked just about anything off this album and enjoyed it. But one of the songs that I think translated best to Unplug and really got to shine, especially from the original album it came from, is Going Blind.
And I know how it should be.
a song you definitely wouldn't expect from Kiss.
No, man, but that it was like a boy, that song and a few other ones off of Unplugged that you didn't really expect.
I mean, World Without Heroes.
That was like a reawakening for Going Blind.
Yeah.
You know, it really made me go back and re-listen to it and go, oh, yeah, that is a good song.
It's such a good song.
Man, the Unplugged version of that tune is just unbelievably good.
Yeah, that song in particular is one of my favorite Kiss songs.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I love it.
All right, also in 96, big news in metal. You know, Rob Halford's gone from Judas Priest, has been for a while. 1996 is the year that they find Ripper Owens, singing for a Priest tribute band, and hires him as the finally a replacement for Rob Halford, and Judas Priest continues on.
With mixed results.
With mixed results, for sure.
I'm not a giant fan of the material that they did with Ripper.
There's some damn good stuff in there, and Ripper is
Ripper's a great singer. I don't know. Demolition.
You ever hear the stuff he did with Iced Earth?
Yeah.
That stuff's good.
I don't have no issue with his voice. It's just the material that Priest was trying to pull off.
Yeah. They were, in the times, man.
That was Glenn Tipton going, what's big now? Let's try that.
Alternative metal.
Yeah. Not really my thing. But hats off for them continuing at least.
Yeah, kept the name alive.
And the footage I've seen of Ripper doing the old stuff is great.
Oh, yeah.
And I almost prefer his version of Diamonds and Rust to Rob's.
Oh, which right is hard on. To believe. Yeah, that is good.
Yeah, because he nailed that song. Okay, so, you know, 96, this is an interesting time for me as a person because the Kiss thing was a big monumental part of our lives. And I was in college. This is my first time living out on my own. And, you know, and I didn't know it at the time, but this was the last year that that I would have my dad around. And my dad passed away in April of 97, which that ties into Kiss, too, because he died the same week I saw the reunion tour.
That's right.
But I learned guitar from my dad. My dad was and my mom both were big Beatles fans. And when I think of 1996 and when I was doing the research for this, it kind of conjured this up. But the Beatles anthology came out in 96. And if you're not familiar with it, it was basically like a multimedia mega event. And there was albums released and a coffee table book. And then there was also the three nights in a row on ABC where there was three parts to the anthology and they aired it three nights in a row.
Right. I remember that.
And it was during the Thanksgiving weekend. And I was home from my first semester in college for that weekend for the holiday. And I just remember that being kind of the last real bonding experience with me and my parents around before we lost my dad. And I hadn't even thought about it since then, but it was watching them get so much joy out of seeing it. Cause that Beatles anthology, if you've never watched it, is pretty incredible. Even if you're not a giant Beatles fan, the way it's put together is just amazing.
Right. It's hard to come away from it not becoming a Beatles fan.
You will if you watch it. Yeah. Did you watch it when it was on?
Yeah,
it was
sure.
So well done. And because, you know, it had all new interviews with all the surviving band members at the time and just all kinds of them. It was just the greatest. I still say it's the best rock documentary I've ever seen.
It was the ultimate celebration of the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, and themselves.
And so in depth. Just so damn in depth. But one of the most important parts of this whole release was they found some tapes of John Lennon doing demos, vocal demos. And they finished the songs out with the three remaining members.
That's awesome.
And that
so
was,
cool.
And I particularly remember, again, they were premiering those songs during the TV. One night they had, the first night it was Free as a Bird, which is a cool song.
Yeah.
And then the second night is this song, which is great. It was a song written by Lennon in 77, demoed a number of times between 79 and 80. And then it was recorded by the three surviving members in 95 for release on this anthology. To date, it's the last released record of new material credited to the Beatles.
Wow.
And it's a song called Real Love.
Girls and boys.
1996, the biggest bands in the world, Kiss and the Beatles.
I mean, it was like one of those things where me and my parents could both celebrate it. Our favorite bands were kind of ruling the world again at the time.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, because you got to figure your parents, when they were young and they were into the Beatles, you know, they probably caught hell from their elders too, you know. And so they look at you kids and your crazy bands like Kiss, you know, and Public Enemy, Eric. And they got to kind of understand, you know.
Yeah. But there was, oh yeah, there was issues with my mom. Like, she tried to get my grandfather to let her go see the Beatles in Memphis in like 66, I think.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't let her go.
Dang.
Yeah. She never forgave him for that either.
No, that's a tough one. It's a tough one to get over.
Right.
All right, so we continue on. As we've learned, by 1996, Atlantic Records has turned their backs on many of the bands that they championed just a few short years earlier. But here's a rock band that they have no problem putting their full support behind. It's the Stone Temple Pilots, who released their third studio album, Tiny Music, Songs from the Vatican Gift Shop, which presents the label with a set of problems all their own, as the band is very unfocused on STP. And Scott Weiland is, well, you know, you guessed it, doing a lot of serious drugs at the time. He's also on probation for attempting to buy crack. Everybody else has moved on to a side band called Talk Show. So they had a bunch of songs to divide into two different albums by two different bands. We'll use this one for Stone Temple Pilots. We'll use this one for the side project. It was all written together,
right?
So they just split it off. The sound they come up with was a lot less grunge and a lot more flavored, like Mark Bolan in 70s styles glam rock. And if there was such a thing, the 1996 award for the weirdest album cover and title combination would definitely go to the Stone Temple Pilots. Strange stuff going on. STP still doing pretty good for themselves, considering that they really don't have their shit together in 1996. The album would go to number 4 on the U.S. charts, backed by the singles Lady Picture Show and Tripping on a Hole in a Paper Heart. The album didn't sell quite as well as the previous two STP releases, possibly because of a lack of much touring for it, due to the insanity that is Scott Weiland. That includes blowing the opening slot for the Mega Kiss reunion tour. I got a picture of a photograph of the wedding in a shell. It's just a burning age of memory. I never kiss and tell.
These days, conversations through your computer, worlds of information one click away. All the things you find only on the world's most popular internet online service, now more affordable than ever. It's like living in the future. The future, now available on America Online.
Hey, I'm Alexi Lalas from the U.S. soccer team. Be sure to fill up with high-quality BP Super 93 and pick up the BP Super Soccer Ball for just $5.99. It's available only at BP stations with an 8-gallon purchase of high-octane BP Super 93, the official gasoline of U.S. soccer. You get great gasoline, this great ball, plus you're helping support the U.S. soccer teams competing this summer. Get on the ball.
BP, we keep it moving.
Friday night, Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls help out the Sonics down the stretch and escape with a 2-0 series lead. Now, as the scene shifts to Seattle, Sean Kemp and company hope that Key Arena will hold the key to victory. The drama builds for Game 3 of the NBA Finals tonight at 7 Eastern on NBC.
All right, welcome back to the Decibel Geek Podcast as we explore the world that is 1996. And man, you know, there's some weird stuff going on in the world of music and entertainment, but as far as sports go, 1996 is a super exciting year. I mean, there's some really awesome stuff going on. Talking about times like Super Bowl 30. The Dallas Cowboys defeat the Pittsburgh Steelers 27-17. This is classic Cowboys time. I'm talking Troy Aikman, Emmitt Smith, Moose Johnston, Michael Irving, and Neon Deion Sanders. Mm-hmm. That's a classic lineup right there. In 96, the Browns leave Cleveland in the dead of night.
Yeah.
Slide on over to Baltimore and become the Ravens. 96 is also the Houston Oilers' final season. And it's also the year that Jimmy Johnson replaces Don Shula as the head coach of the Miami Dolphins. Don Shula had a long run. Keyshawn Johnson is the first selection in the NFL draft. In baseball, the Yankees win the World Series, defeating the Atlanta Braves 4-2. You remember that, don't you?
I'd like to forget, but yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. In the NBA Finals, the Chicago Bulls over the Seattle Supersonics 4-2. This is another classic one here. You know, MVP Michael Jordan. Plus, you got Scottie Pippen, Steve Kerr, John Sally.
Unstoppable.
And the Worm, Dennis Rodman.
Yep.
He was suspended for 11 games that season for kicking the cameraman. You remember that?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that in years.
He was running, and the cameraman kind of got in his way, and then he ended up kicking him.
Yeah.
Suspended for 11 games.
Rodman was certainly a character.
Yeah, he was. 96 is the year Kobe Bryant and Shaq joined the L.A. Lakers.
Yep.
That's going to come into fruition in years coming past 96. In golf, Tiger Woods becomes the first person to win the U.S. Amateur Championship 3 times in a row. So it's the rise of Tiger Woods in 96. In the NHL, at the end of the 95 season, the Quebec Nordiques were sold and relocated, becoming the Colorado Avalanche. In their first season in Denver, they bring the Stanley Cup back to their new home, shutting out the Florida Panthers 4-0.
Wow, their first year.
Not a bad start. NHL's leading scorer and league MVP that year, Pittsburgh Penguin Mario Lemieux.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that guy. 1996, stars of tennis, names you might remember, Boris Becker, Pete Sampras, Monica Seles, and Steffi Graf. And, of course, the 1996 Summer Olympics held in Atlanta, Georgia. You know, with home field advantage and all, the U.S. pretty much dominates, taking 44 gold medals.
Wow.
They did pretty damn good in 96. That's the year with the men's U.S. basketball super team. It's got Karl Malone, Hakeem Olajuwon, Charles Barkley, Shaq, Reggie Miller, all kinds of guys on that team. They bring home gold. Alexi Lalas.
Yeah.
That's the year of Alexi Lalas, 96, the U.S. soccer team. They look strong, but they come up a little short. They beat Tanzania and tie Portugal and lose to Argentina. But the U.S. women's soccer team brings home the gold. But that's the year that makes Alexi Lalas a household name.
Yep.
And in the Olympics also, even though he's kind of on a career slide, Andre Agassi's still around. He brings home some gold in tennis. Now, this is the shaved head Meth Curious era.
Meth Curious?
He's Meth Curious in 96. He's not there yet, but he's kind of thinking about it.
Oh, man.
1996 in the Olympics. That's the year my Olympic hero, Kurt Angle, wins a gold medal in wrestling with a broken freaking neck.
Wow.
Heck yeah. And of course, in the biggest news story in sports, in 1996. So this one's got a little backstory to it. Let me lead you up to this. This is a big, big, huge sports story.
This isn't about
Hang on now a second. You just let me go on. You don't interrupt the most important sports story right now. Throughout 1996, World Championship Wrestling has been repeatedly invaded by two of the WWF's top stars, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash, formerly known as Diesel and Razor Ramon. On July 7th, the two outsiders agree to face the team of WCW loyalists Sting, Lex Luger, and the Macho Man Randy Savage in a 6-man tag team match without revealing the identity of their third man. Even at the time of the match, Hall and Nash come out alone. When Lex Luger goes down to injury, Hulk Hogan... Yeah, that's right. Hulk Hogan makes a surprise appearance to the delight of the fans. Instead of coming to the rescue of the fan favorites, as the most popular wrestler of the 80s has been prone to do, he would instead attack his longtime frenemy, Randy Savage, joining forces with Hall and Nash. fans around the world would erupt with outrage as he ditches the red and yellow, dubs himself Hollywood Hogan, and reinvents himself as the most hated villain of the 90s.
Yep.
NWO for life.
Oh, man.
That's your biggest news story in 1996. Can you believe it?
Biggest news story, and not even biggest
Well, I would go ahead and say the biggest news story of all. Transcending sports.
Wow.
Hollywood Hogan. He is back on top.
I'm glad you didn't. I'm glad you didn't oversell it.
No. Well, that's what I know about sports in 96. Yeah.
Well, I will say it was a genius move writing wise.
Oh, totally.
As how they scripted that out.
Totally, because
no one saw it coming.
From then on, for like 89, somewhere around there. Many, many weeks in a row, yeah. Like years to almost 2 years worth, WCW would actually beat WWF in the ratings. Yeah. So, I mean, it really, it wasn't just a career resurgence for Hogan. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a resurgence for the entire pro wrestling industry that would last for years to come. And that was really the kickoff of it, I think.
Because they knocked the top dog off the block for a little while.
Yeah. Doing some exciting stuff. All right, what do we got going up next? Oh, here's one. Oh, this is great. I always love when I have an opportunity to play and talk about one of my favorite bands. Formed in 1987 as a four-piece called Rude Awakening in Zion, Illinois. When half of their bandmates drop off, Scott Lucas and Joe Daniels dedicate themselves to carry on as a two-piece and change their name to Local H. Their 1995 debut album, Ham Fisted, failed to chart anywhere, but the 1996 concept album, As Good As Dead, would crack the U.S. album charts, topping out at a whopping 147. They get some attention when rock radio picks up on the single, Bound for the Floor. That's like they're rock and roll all night. They got to play it. You know, that's the song they're known for. It's not their best song, but they got some great ones. The song Fritz's Corner is included on the Ozfest double CD set that comes out. And a few rock radio stations even pick up and play the heavily edited High-Fiving Motherfucker. In Stamford, Connecticut, with producer Stephen Hagler, who was doing some good stuff with Clutch around that same time and would go on to do big business with Fuel. It's not my favorite Local H album, but it's not bad. I mean, to me, in my personal opinion, these guys get better and better with every album they come out with, so their most recent is always my favorite, but this one's got some good stuff on it. It's their most highly acclaimed, I would guess,
yeah,
because of that song that everybody knows, nobody really likes. I'm telling you, Local H's got way better songs than that one. But I
hate that song.
Like I said, this one's got that Fritz's Corner on it, and High Five and Motherfucker's a great tune. And
I hate
Freeze-Dried Flies.
I hate Bound for the Floor so much that Macarena also came out in 1996, and I have a hard time deciding which one I like less.
Ooh,
that's how much I don't like.
Ouch, that's tough.
Yeah. One story that would be hard to ignore from 1996 is the arrest of the Unabomber.
Yeah.
And, like, it's such a footnote now, but, gosh, it was – I remember when the hunt was on for the guy, and it was a big story. And
I mean, he made people scared to open their mail for a long-ass time.
And that drawing of him in the hoodie, like, every year there'd be the news would cover it, and, you know, we're still looking for this guy.
Yeah, they busted in on him in 96 in his secluded Montana cabin. His reign of terror is over. He's convicted with 10 counts of illegally transporting, mailing, and using bombs, and 3 counts of murder, and is sentenced to serve 8 life sentences.
Yeah.
That guy's not getting out.
No, not anytime soon.
But once again, people can safely check their mail.
He's a disgrace to fellow Polish people.
For sure.
Yeah.
What a jerk. Here's something interesting that probably most people may not know about. This one, I think probably... in 96, I don't think a lot of people probably got this one, but after this, I'm betting you're going to wish you had. RJ Manning met Eric Dover in 1993 when he was looking for a touring guitarist for his band Jellyfish. They would go on to work together after that band breaks up, and they write an album. But before they can completely record it, Eric Dover auditions for a project that Guns N' Roses guitarist Slash is working on. Dover gets that gig, which would end up becoming Slash's Snake Pit. They record the stellar album, It's 5 o'clock Somewhere, and go on tour until Geffen decides it's time for Slash to rejoin Guns N' Roses and pulls all support, effectively ending Snake Pit and Dover's employment. But that frees him up to pick up where he left off with Manning. They add the rhythm section of Joseph Kames and Eric Scotus, and Imperial Drag is born.
You're rushing us into the music. In fact, you should tend to lean back a little. They call it laid back. It's a sordid term, but that's how it's used.
Instead of getting an offer from Geffen, they end up on Work Records, whose top artist is Jamiroquai.
Oh, boy. There's a sign of the times.
The single Boy or Girl got minimal airplay, and the album did not sell very well, even though it's an extremely enjoyable rock record.
Yeah.
After the great work Dover had done with Snake Pit, it kind of surprises me that they wouldn't have backed Imperial Drag. You know, you'd think you'd have seen, hey, this is pretty good. This album turned out really great. Let's throw some money behind Imperial Drag. I feel like that if this album would have gotten some sort of promotion with its 70s kind of vibe, this band could have been right up there with the Black Crowes, who were kind of doing the same thing and also doing big business in 96.
Yeah, there was a definite resurgence of that style going on. And that's one of those curiosities from that era where it's like, why did this album not succeed? Because it probably should have.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, the whole album is
great material
really good
from start to finish. I mean, and the songwriting's really strong on it.
Yeah, for sure.
King's X in May of that year put out Ear Candy.
It's a great album.
Yeah, it was their 6th studio album, last album that they cut for Atlantic Records. The band was a surprise highlight a couple of years earlier at the Woodstock Festival, but just never turned into a bigger success like people thought they were going to. Ear Candy features a bunch of great playing and cool songs like Picture, Mississippi Moon, and this one that features Toad the Wet Sprocket's Glenn Phillips on backing vocals. It's simply called A Box. King's X has gone on to do a lot of albums with, you know, smaller labels and independent stuff. And one of the more recent albums, Ogre Tones, was recorded here in Nashville with Michael Wagoner.
That's right.
That album's got a lot of good stuff on it, too. If you've never seen King's X live, what are you waiting for? If they come near you, go see them, because they have to be experienced all the way live to understand it.
Yeah, and 96, sign of the times, you know, King's X about to get dropped from their major label.
Yeah, this was one of my favorite albums to get high to back in the 90s.
Yeah. It's a good one for that.
Yeah, there's a lot. That song, A Box in particular, I used to love getting stoned and listening to that song.
Right on.
Yeah. Okay, so another album that really meant a lot to me during this period in 1996 was Down on the Upside by Soundgarden. And this was the last album that they would do for a very long time, I think 16 years. It was their fifth studio album. Definitely a more experimental approach on this album. There's less co-writes from Kim Thayil and more from Chris Cornell and bassist Ben Shepherd. It is kind of an all over the place album, but I like albums that are being done by bands that are falling apart, and this one was no exception. I have a soft spot for this album, as it was my go-to album at the time of a very bad breakup. I was not in a good place mentally at the time, so naturally, the song with 21 utterances of the word fuck would be my favorite track on the album. I'm talking about a song called Ty Cobb.
Ones where, you know, you can think about where you were listening to it when it was new, when you were hearing those songs, and go, oh yeah, 1996.
Yeah, I went through a rough breakup, and that song Ty Cobb kind of helped get me through it, because it's one of those angry songs you just blast.
Right on.
Yeah,
I guess you were about at that age.
Yeah,
learning life, becoming a man.
A lot of changes around that age. Around
with the help
time.
Of Soundgarden.
Yeah.
All right, well, here's something a little different than that. By 1996, Great White are veterans of the rock game, and what a long, strange trip it's been to lead them where they find themselves in 1996. Great White enjoyed success from the very beginning with musicianship, songwriting, exciting live shows, and the managerial prowess of Alan Niven. Their 1984 self-titled debut cracked the U.S. album charts at 144. They're quickly signed to Capitol Records after that. Their next album goes to 82. I mean, that's not bad for a band on the road without any big hit singles. Their popularity really begins to skyrocket with the release of Once Bitten, which takes them even higher on the U.S. charts to number 23. They had hit their height in 89, establishing themselves as one of the biggest rock acts in the world with help from their U.S. top five single, Once Bitten, Twice Shy. The Twice Shy album climbs all the way to number 9. They follow up that with Hooked in 91. It doesn't match the sales of Twice Shy, but still reaches number 18. They fire back in 92 with Psycho City. It only reaches 107, and the band is dropped by Columbia Records.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine that? Selling as many albums as it takes to reach 107 on the charts in the U.S. and having that be deemed such a failure that you need to be dropped from your label.
Yep.
I mean, that's still a lot of albums and a lot of money in 96.
Grunge was on its way in.
It's a sign of the old alternative times, I guess.
Yep.
They end up signing with Zoo Entertainment, where they are label mates with Green Jelly.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought that was kind of funny.
That'd be a cool tour.
They released Sail Away, which Jack Russell has described as Great White trying to be the Eagles.
I like that album.
The title track is an AOR hit, and they managed to stay on the charts at 168. But the experiment is viewed as a major failure. They end up firing longtime manager, producer, musical collaborator Alan Niven, and decide to get back to their roots and create the kind of classic, no-frills, meat-and-potatoes, bluesy hard rock album that made them rock demigods in the late 80s. And in 1996, they release Let It Rock. Seems like a long way to get here to go through all this band's albums to highlight just how popular they were during their entire career. Mm-hmm. But it's important to get the big picture to realize that after all those years and all that success, 1996 would mark the first time that a Great White album would fail to crack the U.S. top 200 album charts.
Wow.
Although it's largely ignored at the time, and I guess nowadays too, pretty much, Let It Rock is a really killer Great White album, and I mean, it's solid all the way through. I mean, these guys were trying to just be Great White again, and they nailed it, and they killed it.
Yeah.
But in 96, nobody gave a shit.
So, another band that definitely was probably, you know, and it's funny because they were coming off some real big success just a couple of years earlier with Scorpions.
Right.
You know, that Wind of Change song was, what, 90, 91, I think?
Yeah, it's not too long.
Not too long before this, and that was a massive hit. And then by 1996, they put out Pure Instinct on May 21st as their 13th studio album. It's the only Scorpions album on which session musician Kurt Kress plays drums. So they didn't even really have a full-time drummer, I guess, at the time. This album is weird, they were trying to kind of rely on a tried-and-true thing, because Winds of Change was not a love song, but it was a ballad.
Right.
And I think they probably were viewing, well, ballads work for us, so then they put more ballads than non-ballads on this record, which that's a no-no. And it's funny, I'm a ballads guy, I like ballads, but...
But even that was too much.
It's too much. Well, even the most recent album they did, I think it's called Return to Forever.
Yeah.
Like, there's like half the songs are ballads.
Right.
It's like...
Some of the best songs in that one are the bonus tracks that really rock.
Let's not go over the top here. But this song and one other were produced by 80s mega producer Keith Olsen. And they've got this sound straight out of the 80s, and it's got a good riff on it. And we're going into the break with Scorpions doing a song from 1996 called Wild Child.
Spend my life in pursuit of cool, which, like energy, can neither be created nor destroyed, only enjoyed. Sometimes I cannot be as one with cool, too busy with the grind. But when I shake loose, I home in on cool like a bird dog with my Motorola pager. It's how I stay connected with my very cool friends. So when my Motorola pager beeps or vibrates, I know that somewhere coolness is calling. Get a Motorola pager and know. Now, not knowing is not cool.
Motorola, what you never thought possible.
Gentlemen, now I know we have our differences, different jobs, different deodorants, different phone companies. Truth is, regardless of who we are, what we are, or what phone company we choose, every one of us can use 1-800-COLLECT to save money on collect calls.
1-800-COLLECT.
I use 1-800-COLLECT.
I'm feeling a lot of love here.
1-800-COLLECT. Anyone can use it, everyone can save.
When a family careens into a raging river, rescuers battle overwhelming odds.
His baby was going to die.
America's Stories, Rescue 911, CBS Next. Saturday, a major motion picture event.
I think he's the most dangerous man I've ever known.
Chuck Norris.
I'm going to take him down.
A special walker at a special time, CBS Saturday. Conspiracy, kidnapping, murder, and the clues lead to Jessica.
She's got to catch me.
A captivating episode of Murder, She Wrote, CBS Sunday.
This is CBS.
Whoa.
Coming back to the Decibel Geek Podcast, talking about 1996, talking about hard rock, metal, sports, all kinds of cool stuff, news stories, things going on. And, you know, it's always cool to look back at these times, and it gives you a good spotlight of, you know, where was I in 96? And I always think a really cool way to put that into perspective is to look at what was big on TV in 96.
Yeah, I think I was mostly watching King of the Hill and Beavis and Butthead around this time.
Yeah, but, yeah.
And Cheech and Chong movies.
Right.
But notable, there were some notable things that happened in the television industry that year, including the first HD projection television.
Oh, wow.
Which probably cost who knows how much.
Right, yeah. Insanely expensive when it was new.
Also, Nickelodeon debuted TV Land. Remember that? Where they would
show the old shows.
The old shows.
Like the monkeys and stuff. Yeah,
Dick Van Dyke show. Yeah. I used to love those shows. MTV premiered M2 because people were bitching about not enough music on the channel. So they were like, okay, here's another channel that plays music.
And now there's no M2 no more
that
either.
Failed. The ending of the Phil Donahue show. Of course, Kiss fans will remember the Peter Criss episode of that show.
I stayed home sick from school to watch that.
My dad taped it for me while I was at school. And I got home and he was like, you're never going to believe what I taped for you today.
Yeah. I can't believe I'm letting you watch this garbage.
No, he enjoyed it. He got caught up in the whole thing, too.
Oh,
he
wow.
thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
probably the biggest thing that got the most viewership hours was the O.J. Simpson trial started in 1996. Okay, so the top 10 shows of 1996 were, number 10 was NYPD Blue, which I used to love that show, 60 Minutes, Boston Common, which I didn't think that show was that popular, Home Improvement, The Single Guy. Do you even remember The Single Guy? I don't even remember that show.
I don't remember The Single Guy.
Monday Night Football was number 5.
Yeah, of course, that's always going to be right up there.
Caroline in the City was number 4. And then the top 3 were really big shows. Friends was 3, Seinfeld was 2, and the number 1 show in 1996 was ER.
Oh, wow.
Remember, ER was a
ER,
big show.
Friends, and Seinfeld. Yeah. Yep, that's 1996 for sure.
George Clooney was a TV star in 1996.
Yeah.
other notable shows that year that are included were Frasier, Coach, which I used to love watching.
Coach was cool.
The Dana Carvey Show, which lasted all of 7 really inappropriate episodes.
I don't even remember that.
It was really funny, but it was not made for primetime television.
Really? Yeah. Very risque?
Very. And then the greatest show, of course, on television, Walker, Texas Ranger.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of my favorites from around then.
Yeah. All right. So
I was a big fan of Superman the Animated Series, too.
Were you?
Yeah, I like that
show. Okay. All right. So in May, Pantera put a record out.
Oh, yeah. I remember the anticipation for this one.
Me, too. I was a first-day buyer.
Yes.
The Great Southern Trendkill came out on May 22nd. It was their 8th studio album, released on East West Records. Reached number 4 on the Billboard 200 chart and stayed on the chart for over 16 weeks. And that's for an album this heavy, that's pretty damn impressive.
Yeah.
To stay on the Billboard chart for that long. Due to tension and conflicts within the band, Philip Anselmo recorded his vocals alone at Trent Reznor's Nothing Studios in New Orleans.
Wow.
While the rest of the band recorded the music at Chase and Jason Studios in Dallas, Texas. This album is incredible and has a ton of killer tracks, including the title track, Drag the Waters, 13 Steps to Nowhere, and War Nerve. Every inch of planet Earth. That's poetry.
It is some sort of poetry.
And then,
violent, angry poetry.
And I thought it was summed up nicely in a review from Melody Maker from 1996. The review says, "It makes my brain hurt, my eyes water, and my genitalia retract like a startled turtle. I cannot think of a higher recommendation considering the kind of album that it is."
Right.
That's Pantera.
It was out of this world, man. To top the stuff they'd come out with before, it was like, you know, by the time they got to Strength or
Reinventing the Steel,
they were so freaking heavy. And it's like, how do you do one more than that? But yeah, awesome album. I love that one. It's cool that the thrash metal bands in the age of alternative rock are actually doing all right for themselves, a lot of them. And, you know, including that pick and the next two, we're going to be talking about three of the biggest thrash icons out there. And the next one I've got is another story like that, because while many thrash bands are kind of floundering or changing their style in the mid-90s, Slayer is doing what they want to do and still holding their own. They're still riding the success of Divine Intervention, recorded with Toby Wright, and they headlined a world tour supported by Machine Head and Biohazard, and they were also at the top of the Monsters of Rock festival bill with Skid Row and Metallica. Having done all that, it's time for Slayer to do something for themselves, and they record a tribute album to their favorite punk rockers, and they call it The Lasagna Dilemma.
Really?
I was hoping for a laugh.
Oh.
Never mind. They call it Disputed Attitude.
Well, I don't know. I didn't know if it was for real.
You know, like Spaghetti Incident?
No, I get it.
Lasagna Dilemma?
Yeah.
Oh, it's no funny if I got to explain it. It includes two songs written by Hanneman and Lombardo, along with Rocky George from Suicidal Tendencies. It also covers a bunch of bands like Iggy and the Stooges, TSOL, Minor Threat, and DRI, plus a brand new Slayer original track called Gemini. In 1996, Slayer will also appear at Ozfest on the top of the bill behind only the Prince of Darkness himself. It's good times for Slayer in the mid-90s. They're doing all right.
Yeah, they kind of weathered the storm with the grunge thing.
Yeah, they did.
You know, they...
Man, I can't believe my Lasagna Dilemma joke fell so flat.
My brain was in somewhere else. When I hear Slayer, I tune out.
I feel like I just did like a jumping high five and you weren't there and I fell flat on my face.
I left you hanging. I'm sorry, bro.
Damn it, 96 has got us all out of our element.
I'm sure you guys listening got a laugh, though.
So we're talking about Pantera, Slayer, talking about, you know, thrash masters, legendary artists in the thrash genre. And that brings us up to the biggest music-related story of 1996. Metallica's haircuts.
Right. I remember
the hell's going on? That was it, man. You took one look at Metallica and their goofy haircuts were like, wait a minute, something's not right here.
Oh, they had mascara on, too.
And all that, yeah. I mean, I read recently in an article that said, Lars recently said in an interview with an Orlando radio station that it had been 3 years since anyone had seen the band and that they'd all gotten haircuts on their own. And, you know, it was just coincidence, not a thought-out image change. But I've also read statements from James Hetfield where he says all that shit was Kirk and Lars trying to reinvent the band in a new era.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I buy that whole thing. I mean, yeah, the internet wasn't prevalent and people didn't have, you know, cameras that took pictures back then.
Yeah.
But these guys were still out playing live and stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Lars always struck me as a trend follower, though.
If I had the time, or I challenged somebody that maybe does have the time, go back and look at concert footage from between the Black Album and between 96 and see if
I
they
saw them
did.
At that time.
Did they all get their haircuts at the same time or was it really little by little?
When I saw them, I saw them when they were promoting Live Shit, Binge, and Purge.
Yeah.
But they still all had their hair at that point.
Right?
Yeah. But that was in between.
Yeah.
But I don't know. No, it didn't. I'd hazard a guess that it was planned.
It was planned. You know, it was planned. They even changed the band logo and made that a lot less cool.
Yeah, they fucked up. They went and fucked up their own logo, too. And then they started calling themselves Talica, which was annoying as
shit.
That's
not cool.
Even though I kind of agree with it because there was no metal.
Right? Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. And I guess James went along with the weird-ass videos and shit as a concession for including a country and western number on the album.
Oh, God.
Man, I'll never forget Crazy seeing times. The video for Until It Sleeps for the first time. My mind was blown in a really bad way. The song wasn't really metal. Kirk looked like Carlos Santana in drag. Lars is angry about his feather boa and being molested by Satan.
All right.
Jason appears to be smearing poop all over himself. And then you got the cowboy James over there. You got Jesus over here. Horsehead man's over there. And all kinds of other crazy shit that was nothing like the Metallica that I knew and loved.
Where do I take this pain of mine? I run, but it stays right by my side. So tear me open, pull me out. The things inside that scream and shout. And the pain still hates me. So hold me until
see, now, at least this gave the fans that bitched about Metallica selling out on the Black Album a reason to give that album a new appreciation.
Right.
I mean, it's still sold like crazy, going 5 times platinum and topping the U.S. album charts at numero uno. But it had been 5 years since a new Metallica album, and people were pretty excited. This phase of Metallica would last for 2 more albums and 12 more years.
Yep.
I always felt bad for the people of a younger generation because this was their Metallica.
Yeah, but I mean,
sad.
You gotta look at the sales.
The sales were there. I mean, and I can't totally bitch. I mean, Load wasn't complete garbage.
There's moments.
There's moments on there. It's better than what you got coming up for the next 2 albums.
Reload is complete shit.
And Saint Anger.
I'll
take Load over Saint Anger.
Oh yeah, I'll take every album in their catalog over Saint Anger.
Yeah.
But Load, I thought it was poetic that the cover of Load is a bunch of sperm. It's just their way of saying
this album is a load.
We've creatively shot our wad, so enjoy.
They were trying to do something cool and creative, but I mean,
well, there's a moment in some kind of monster documentary where you actually see them talk. They show their true colors on how they feel about these records.
Yeah.
Where they're sitting around the table and they're, you know, because Saint Anger was them. They were stuck for ideas. And they're sitting around the table trying to figure out what to do next because none of the stuff's working. And Lars at one point goes, well, you know, he said something like, I think we have pieces of stuff that we could cobble together to create something that sounds kind of like a Metallica record. I mean, that's what we did with the Load and Reload albums. And James kind of laughs and goes, yeah. So, I mean, that tells you right there. They knew it's a band that had run out of ideas.
Yeah, and I guess what you do is you don't want to put out, you know, Black Album Part 2, but not as good.
Right.
So the best thing you can do is come up with something totally different so that people can say, well, this isn't as good as that. And you say, well, but this is way different than that. You can't compare this to that because we've intentionally done this.
Right.
I don't know, man. Not good times to be a Metallica fan. Not in my recognition, anyway. But I mean, like I said, there's people out there that are younger than me that this was their Metallica. And, you know, the stuff before it wasn't as good. But I don't understand that.
I don't either.
It was a sad time for me because, I mean, it's a roller coaster in 96. You know, you get the rush and the amazingness of Kiss coming back. And then it's like, oh, Metallica's back too. Oh, wait. Ooh, what's this?
Well, if you were depressed about Metallica, you still had porn.
Still had porn?
Yeah.
You definitely did, because in 93 we found out
96.
That internet porn is okay.
Yes. The Communications Decency Act of 96 began as the government's attempt to regulate internet porn, but became a huge debate over the First Amendment. In the end, the U.S. government ruled that they could not impede upon adults' rights to free speech by restricting the creation and or consumption of pornographic material. They could, however, use the act to protect minors from receiving, viewing, or being forced into participating in porn, and were A-okay with that.
See, nothing wrong with that. You know, 96, it just shows that how important the internet is becoming. I mean, I think the stat for 96 was something like in 95, like 1 million homes had internet, you know, or had, you know, home computers. By 96, it's like 10 million.
Yeah.
It's very prevalent now.
96 was the, well, late 95 was when I discovered the internet, was when I first got on it.
Yeah, because, I mean, this is the time now, it's where, to the point where they're having to look at it and go, okay, we have to make laws and rules about this because this is obviously going to become an all-consuming, everyday part of our lives, you know, and it needs to be watched just like any other aspect of life, I guess.
Yeah, well, there's a whole discussion we could have along those lines in today's society.
Right, yeah.
With recent rulings on things.
Right, true. Neutrality and all that.
Yeah, there's a whole talk to be had there. VIP content.
Okay, maybe. Cool. I was going to ask you about all that.
Yeah. So, Zakk Wylde puts Book of Shadows out in June of 1996.
Oh, yeah.
This was his first solo album, much different in tone than the stuff he had done with Ozzy and Black Label. The music on this is a lot more representative of, I'd say, of the Pride and Glory material, as well as Zach's influences growing up.
Yeah.
There's some powerful songs on this album, including Throwing It All Away, which was written about Shannon Hoon from Blind Melon. And Zakk was actually Shannon's roommate when Shannon OD'd.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
I particularly love the single Way Beyond Empty, which sounds like the best Allman Brothers songs that Allman Brothers never did.
If I could, I surely would child ease your pain. But if I could no longer, would you still know my name? If I could, I'd drink the tears that pour from these eyes. Would you turn your back on me? Would you wave goodbye? Leave me way beyond empty inside. Waiting my last day to arrive.
Yeah, that's a great album, man. I love that
one.
If I'm metal and southern rock and you know, a little, like you said, that song's kind of like Allman Brothers ish, and I love it a lot. That's a really good one.
I think it's the best thing he's ever done, you know, outside of Ozzy.
Yeah, really?
I like this. I like this over the Black Label stuff myself.
Oh, I don't know.
Although, Pride and Glory is pretty great, too.
Pride and Glory is awesome. Zakk Wylde's a talented dude, you know, and obviously has been for a long time. Has, you know, flourished with Ozzy since he's in the early days, and, you know, did good in the 90s and is still going strong today. You know, that's a testament to this guy's staying power.
Right.
It's good stuff.
So,
what have we learned today?
Gosh.
That Kiss is back together.
Yeah.
Woo!
And the Metallica's confused.
Well, we're all confused by Metallica.
Yeah, it's an interesting, and we're only halfway through the year, so
there's a lot of great stuff in the second part of the year too.
Yeah,
a lot of crazy shit.
There's another half of the year to go, so it's been an interesting year to look back on. A lot of personal feelings about stuff that was going on at the time. This one kind of hits more close to home for me than some of the 80s ones we did, because I was just a little kid then.
Right, yeah, because the 80s and 70s stuff we look back is like a research and retrospective kind of thing. Or not so much retrospective, because we weren't there, but 96, I mean, we were young men.
I was right in the middle of everything.
With feelings and emotions and acne and anger. Acne and anger.
There's a band name.
Don't let Tui hear you say that.
Yeah, I know. That's why I said that. No, but it's an interesting year to look back on, and considering, you know, and music was a real blender of stuff, I think, as we've shown. It wasn't just grunge and alternative, but and actually, before I came over, I just flipped through a playlist on Spotify of just, like, hits from 1996. Oh, boy.
Oh, man, terrible hit music.
Ooh, rough time. Even for top 40 music was bad.
Right, as we always seem to end the second year part, we'll say, hey, you think it was all this music was great, but it wasn't all good 96. Oh, man, none of it was good 96 other than what we're playing on these two episodes, I think.
A lot of Mariah Carey and Bone Thugs and Harmony.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff I hadn't listened to since 96.
Tough times, man. Yeah. Tough times for hard rock and metal, but we're powering through it. And we're finding you the best stuff about it and all the funny, interesting stories that go along with it. And we will be back next week for part two of it. If you have noticed that we have missed something that you loved in 1996 in the first part of the year, hey, when you see this go up on our Facebook page and on Twitter, you know, make your comments on there. Let us know, hey, you guys missed this important album that came out on the first part of the year in 1996. And hey, even let us know what you'd like to hear us talk about in the next year or the next half of the year, because that's coming up next week and we're about to start our homework on it.
I cut about three or four songs I had initially picked, so I'm sure some people are going, where was Sepultura? You
know, right, had some other stuff me on too.
But yeah, I mean, obviously for both of us as giant Kiss fans, Kiss was sort of the centerpiece of that year for us.
For sure.
For a lot of people, but it was an exciting summer, and I remember, you know, June... Just all the build-up, seeing all the media attention, all the magazine covers. It was crazy. It was our taste of the 70s.
Right. It was as close as guys like us could get that were too young to experience the frenzy of Kiss in the 70s to be able to kind of say, okay, this is kind of what it was like. Because in 96, I mean, Kiss Mania, I mean, they really were the biggest band in the world, at least in my perspective, because they were everywhere.
They were certainly the most exposed band in the world at the time, because it seemed like every media outlet was wanting a piece of it.
Of course. I mean, you got those guys looking like the way they do
except
your
Rolling
album
Stone,
cover.
Of course.
Yeah.
They still said fuck them. But the
took them a long time to come around.
But the four Spin magazine covers were pretty awesome.
Yeah, I remember those. Those were cool as hell.
I remember picking those up in the store and just... I mean, seeing those on the magazine rack, like, holy shit, this is actually real.
Can you believe it? Yeah.
Yeah. And
I mean, just a couple years prior, my friends are beating me up because I listen to Forever.
Right. Hey, I like Kiss. I've always liked Kiss. I mean, how many times did people bullshit their way and say, I've always been a Kiss fan?
It's like, damn right.
If all the people that said they were always a Kiss fan were for real, then Kiss would have sold multi-millions in the 80s.
Right. They would have never had to reunite.
Right. They would still be wearing the Asylum outfits.
Bunch of bandwagon jumpers.
Yeah, but as part of, you know, of course, and they opened they did their warm-up show at the K-Rock Weenie Roast, which was a disaster. I had that on bootleg video, but they had all kinds of technical problems and stuff catching on fire. Like, part of the roof catches on fire, and they're playing during the beginning of Deuce, the firehouse siren starts going off halfway through the song.
Oh, this is working out all the kinks. Yeah.
And then, like, remember at the end of Love Gun, Paul would use his guitar like a gun and the fireworks would go off. At the beginning of Love Gun, somebody triggered the fireworks to go off at the very beginning of the song. And all of a sudden, they're looking around like, what the hell just happened? If you ever get a chance to watch the video of that show, it's pretty funny. But of course, Tiger Stadium in Detroit was the proper intro for the tour. And if you watch, and actually, you know, it's funny on the Kissology video, that's just a screen feed, so it doesn't really capture the craziness. But our friend Chris Epting, who did those GPS episodes with us, I sent this to him because I found this, and I'll send it to you, and I'll post it on the Facebook page this week. It's an audience shot thing from the upper deck of Tiger Stadium. It's like nosebleed section. But it's the perfect vantage point to watch the intro to the show because you see the entire audience from this vantage point and you see the intro. And when that guy goes, the hottest band in the world, Kiss, and that curtain drops for Deuce, it is like, I get goosebumps talking about it, but you have to watch this video. The whole crowd just goes ape shit.
I suppose.
I mean, it's a straight up roar.
I mean, how many people from all over the world?
Oh, yeah.
You know, the moment they found out. I mean, I think that show sold out in record time.
It was like 20 minutes or something.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Like minutes. And
right.
It was like, I think that's like 50,000 seats or something crazy. If you watch that video, even if you just watch the beginning for Deuce, it's just. because you can, I mean, they look like stick figures on stage, but just seeing the whole crowd just go insane is like, wow. I mean, that's awesome. You'll get a little, and I can only imagine, I'm sure some of you listening were actually there. And if you were, share it with us because we wanted to live it through you. But
just, or even just other, to see that. Even other stops on that tour where you were seeing Kiss reunited for the first time. Yeah. I'll never forget it at the Bradley Center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Yeah. I got actually, I take that back.
The first one I seen them at was in the Twin Cities.
Oh, really?
In Minneapolis. Second time I seen them on the reunion was in Milwaukee.
I bet you and Vaco were at the same show.
I'm sure we probably were.
That's cool.
Yeah.
But so I want to play something out with something to kind of celebrate the Kiss reunion, which, well, this is funny because they in preparation for that tour, they put out You Wanted the Best, You Got the Best, which was a compilation of Alive 1 and Alive 2. And some big air quotes, unreleased songs from the 70s.
I never knew till today.
Oh, I knew right away. You didn't know till today?
No, I didn't until I was you.
Kinda, oh, really?
Yeah, no. All right. I never knew about this rumor. I didn't know it was true.
Well, and when this came out, it mostly received negative reviews as a cash grab. And it is, but it's a cool cash grab.
But it was great because it was unreleased live era music from the original band, right? I mean, songs that were supposed to be included on Kiss Alive and Kiss Alive 2 that were left out because there wasn't room for them, these original versions of these songs. How cool is that?
Well, there's debate. But, I mean, well, the vocal, there's no way that the vocals were recorded in the 70s.
Yeah.
You listen to them, you can tell that that's 90s era Paul and Gene.
I just thought maybe it was polished up with today's,
those are total re-recorded vocals.
Mixologists.
Yeah, but Paul's voice changed a lot from the 70s to now.
Right.
And Gene was doing all that Cookie Monster shit back in the 70s. It would have sounded different. And that, so the vocals, I'm sure, are changed. The drums... I don't know. That sounds a lot more like Eric Singer than Peter Criss to me.
Yeah.
And then Bruce Kulick did confirm that he recorded some stuff for this album. Well, what else would he have recorded on?
Right.
It certainly wasn't the tracks from Alive 1 and Alive 2.
No.
So I think it's the Revenge lineup recording all these songs.
Wow.
I think they may have taken tapes.
Pretty damn cool nonetheless.
I think they may have done overdubs on original tapes to try to keep the original feel.
Right.
But I'm saying all this, but I still love all the tracks. I think it's great. And like a lot of people gave them shit for the interview with Jay Leno at the end. I loved that. I thought it was great to hear them talking and cracking up
the first time.
Yeah, I mean, it's something you don't listen to repeatedly.
Right.
But it was cool. Like, I remember... you know, being all caught up in the reunion fever and listening to that going, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I bought the vinyl for this.
They don't hate each other. This might actually work.
Right. Yeah. Oh, we all bought into that at the time, but yeah, if only we could get to 96 and then just freeze time.
Yeah.
But,
I just want to stay in 96.
Yeah. But You Wanted the Best, You Got the Best. This is a fun little thing to have from that era. And if you were around at the time buying music, it was exciting to buy it.
Yep. I bought it.
So this is one of the quote-unquote unreleased tracks from You Wanted the Best. That's the end of 1996, Year Interview Part 1. This is Let Me Know, and we'll see you next week.
See ya. Love it, love it.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.